Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us again here on The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. This is like, I don't know. I mean, I started this like 2010, so I think we're up to like 700 authors. Today, Taiping Chen is a fiction writer. She'll be joining us. She's also a journalist whose debut collection of short stories, Land of Big Numbers, was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt on February 2nd. And it's in our store right now, and it's on the front table because I like it so much. Her fiction's been published in The New Yorker, Grandpa, and Tin House, which unfortunately no longer exists. She's a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Philadelphia, half an hour away from where we're broadcasting right now. She was previously based in Beijing and Hong Kong. She's reported on rice cookers, wrongful convictions, gotten hung up on Edward Snowden. And the reason I'm reading this is because she's eaten more robot-cooked noodles than she can count, which we'll figure later on in our interview. And she lives, like I said, very close to us in a really wonderful place. So, Land of Big Numbers. First, in the acknowledgments, Taiping says a big thank you to the Wall Street Journal for the chances, she says, to live in so many places that fired her imagination. I'm envious of that acknowledgment. What a wonderful blessing. So Land of Big Numbers is 10 short stories. And as you know, I love short stories. The characters are from China, or pretty much almost. And their stories may not be happy or necessarily fulfilling ones, but they vibrate with a meaning that is uplifting in an unusual kind of way. People striving, people hoping, people on their way to somewhere. They may not get there, but they have journeys that are courageous, they're hopeful, and sometimes even silly. So it's always a surprise when you realize that tales of those from thousands of miles away are tales of us as well. I've found in my journeys that people are pretty much the same everywhere. It's the governments that suck. So America is a good place to start. But don't get me started on America. So welcome to Ping, and thanks so much for joining us today on The Avid Reader.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. And again, I'm so excited to know, you know, that you are not too far away at all and look forward to venturing out to make a visit. And thank you for that really kind introduction. I'm so pleased that you enjoyed the stories.
I did. So I guess I ought to ask, what kind of perspective, and it must be an amazing one, have you gained from your time at the Wall Street Journal and the travel that the job gave you, the freedom that you acknowledge gratefully at the end?
Yeah, well, I was chuckling a little bit during your introduction just then, because I really liked how you put it, you know, just finding these commonalities that exist even in places that are, you know, so different on paper in many ways, and of course exist under really different governments. But that is something that I found really, you know, most compelling about my time with the Wall Street Journal, living in these different places, was just being so struck by, you know, the emotional journeys that existed in these, you know, I lived variously in places like Beijing and Hong Kong with the journal and got to travel extensively throughout China. And that always, you know, as a reporter there, of course, you're writing so much about the grand scale of, you know, state policy, U.S.-China relations and Trump and Xi, but it was always the personal and the human that struck me. And I think very much along the lines of what you just said, because so much of what I saw there and encountered, whether it was, you know, an elderly man, you know, story of a farmer trying to build an airplane, or a, you know, retired couple falling out of love. It was all eminently relatable, even when it took place in, you know, of course, places that were very far outside of my own familiarity, having been born and raised in the U.S.
That's kind of what my follow-up question was, and you answered it. Was, you know, the stories, as I said, they don't resonate only as stories, but in the background, it's not that you can, I don't mean it this way, that you can tell you're a Wall Street Journal journalist, but there's an additional kind of shade that we wouldn't have known before we read the book, and that's what's really cool about it. And one of the reviews talks about, I didn't like the way they said it, because they said, oh, no, another book, another short story collection from a journalist. And I'm thinking, what the hell is that supposed to mean? And the other one, one interview, and I won't name the interviewer, but she started with, what is your book about? So remind me that if I ever ask that question, I need to stop my show forever.
That's the hardest question to answer. What is the book about?
And it's kind of dumb. It's like what you get on Good Morning America because they haven't read your book. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the short stories. So Lulu, the first one, in my mind, she's kind of a heroine, but not so to her family. Maybe Big Brother is ambivalent, boss, and he's also somewhat caring. Incidentally, why did you call her, like the first word of the book is Lulu? Is that a Chinese name
It is a Chinese name. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know someone like her or of someone like her?
There are many people like her. I mean, I think there's a lot of, so on, you know, in a literal sense, so Lulu tells the story, of course, of a pair of twins, one who ends up becoming a professional video gamer, that's the brother, and then his sister, who takes a much more dangerous path and becomes this sort of online dissident activist, starts out as a brilliant young student, but her life takes a different turn. And so on that level, you know, someone who's an online activist and sort of a citizen journalist, that's something that, you know, it was in China, although, of course, the media ecosystem is tightly controlled, there are people who do try and, you know, write their own script and tell their own stories and end up in trouble like Lulu does. And that is absolutely something that I wrote about at the Wall Street Journal. So yes, the answer would be yes. But also, I think different shades of Lulu, right? That sort of character that she is, and just that stubbornness married to idealism. It was, I feel like I was encountering shades of that character repeatedly in my time in China, you know, not always taken to such extremes, but in ways big or small, whether it was something, you know, like starting your own business or in her case, starting this online blog dedicated to chronicling protests and that sort of thing. I mean, I do think that's the kind of spirit that you encounter frequently in China. And that was something that I wanted very much also these stories to pay tribute to.
Yeah, I know. I kept thinking of Alexei Navalny, especially right now, mm-hmm. who's one of the most brave. I couldn't do what either of them did. It's you have to be so brave, and your life, your health, your freedom, and most of all, your family. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine how you become a person like that. It's not like a Buddhist monk immolating himself, because there's no chance of change due to that. But there really is, and maybe a small one, but there is a possibility that what they're doing may change things. And of course, in the story, it's juxtaposed with her brother's eventual modicum of success, and a father who's being unreasonable, but no different than I would be as a father. And it's like you were going to call it Replay instead of Lulu, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You read that interview with the New Yorker. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a phrase that was in my head, and it struck me. So, you know, we see the video gamer, the brother, getting to play these games online with no sense really of repercussions, right? You can die and you get reborn over and over again. And that struck me just so much, that sense of poignancy, that his decisions and motion online was free of consequences in a way that his sister's was not. And that contrast, and just for me, I mean, the story, of course, is about Lulu, but I felt as I was writing it, I mean, I was so fascinated by the journey of her brother, right, and his evolution, and also the family. And, you know, that was always a question that haunted me when writing about the sorts of stories like Lulu as a journalist, was just, you know, all the people surrounding them who loved them very much and had to see a loved one go down this kind of path, and just that mingled sense of horror and also admiration, and also, you know, like we see with the father, mingled with the sense of what's the point, you know, where do you think you're going with this, and at the same time you're harming your family, and all these kinds of, you know, mixed layers of choices that someone like Lou ends up having to make, and all of her different loyalties too that end up coming into play.
Yeah, and it's, you do this a lot, and it's really cool for a first-time author of a compilation of short stories, is there's always a couple of lines or at the end, which I'll try not to spoil any of the endings, there's always something that's like, oh, or like a wow moment. Like when she posts the pictures of the goats, it's like she's almost trying to get back what she could have had. You know, it's like it could have been this way, where I'd be like other people, just enjoying the beauty or the cuteness of things, you know, the way they were leaping in the air, almost as if she was hoping she could change. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is her father getting sick as he does at dinner. You know, I could see that happening to me. Mm-hmm. They loved her and they had these expectations, but she doesn't have time for that.
Yeah, and they love her and they want the best for her. And those visions of, you know, what she has and theirs just don't align.
So next would be Hotline Girl. And lately in a lot of books, and I feel as if this one especially, you feel as if someone's writing about the near future. And then you realize, oh, they're writing about right now. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are absolutely, you know, I wrote these stories before COVID, but I have been struck repeatedly by readers who've been telling me that they read as though they were written amid the pandemic, because there are absolutely there are things in Hotline Girl, which of course is set in near future China, but many things I think feel pretty, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, there's that detail in the story about how Bai wears this kind of pass, right, around the city to indicate her status as a resident, and that certainly does seem to echo some of what we're seeing in China now, you know, in terms of how people have to have health passes to move about the city. So yeah, I think there are things in the stories, including Hotline Girl, that definitely seemed fictional when I was writing them and perhaps less fictional now.
Yeah, it's like there was this book, The Circle by Dave Eggers, and it's like working for a giant company where you have to respond so many times in an hour, and if you don't, you get demerits and things like that. It's kind of like what happened. And then mm-hmm. the other thing is the signs. Is it like it has been in China when I've been there? You might see a billboard that says, for better cheer and energy, or five things to do before you go to bed. Are there really those kinds of things?
So that's the kind of thing that you get a lot through state media, which has, you know, a lot of different channels, of course. You know, things like obviously print as well as like TV, but so much of it too coming through social media, you know, some pop-ups on your phone, much like the character experiences in her story. Or as we see in her story of, you know, she looks down and she sees these notifications pop up of, you know, here are the five ways to wake up more refreshed and things like that, that are absolutely part of that sort of chirpy kind of incessant barrage that you do get when you subscribe to those kinds of state media propaganda feeds, which for me always just that contrast of like the chirpy grandmotherly voice in your ear, married to also, of course, some of the kind of darker themes that come up in those sorts of messages that state media promotes. I mean, that juxtaposition always struck me. And it was part of what I was trying to evoke.
Yeah, it's almost like 1984. Well, it is, kind of. And then, see, that's the other thing you do in this story is you switch it around and you bring in, I'm going to mispronounce a lot of these names, but I'm saying, is it Keju or Keju?
Keju.
Mm-hmm. Keju. You know, you throw him in there, and you throw a lot of guys in there that are really jackasses. But, you know, he seems to be an unreliable narrator. And the way you let us know that is when she goes, fire is not something to hide from, mm-hmm. you know. And then, like his cruelty, and like many women, not to be chauvinistic, she puts up with it until she doesn't. Mm-hmm. Like when he says things like, she's as flat as I am, mm-hmm. or, you know, you never were a singer, and he insults her mm-hmm. after she agrees to meet him, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what, you know, and you say that, there's three or four guys in this book that are like that.
It's funny, and yet as I was writing those characters, you know, like Kojiro, he's somebody I had so much empathy for too as a character, though. You know, you think about his family, right? Like they were, when he was growing up, they were sort of the remnants of the countryside, and eventually, you know, were moved to the cities and just lived this really dislocated life and felt unmoored. And for him, you know, he was someone who, an only child, like, you know, most of his generation, felt lonely and lost in this big city, and or a bigger city, that is, and, you know, had this relationship with the girl he loved. And he was a flawed character who had his own you know, was prone to using violence as a way to get attention. And yet I really felt for him. He spent a long time obsessing over this girl, follows her into the city finally. And yeah, he's a flawed character, but he is somebody who I did feel a lot of heart for too in writing him.
You're kinder than I am. And then here's,
yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
That's all right. I was just gonna move on to New Fruit. Please, and here's why I want it to be on video. Does that look like the New Fruit?
Oh. No. That looks,
sorry.
No, but I like the attempt very much. So that looks like an orange, and the New Fruit in the story is much more evoked by a nectarine. So if you have any of those, or like a peach laying around, but I was picturing a nectarine very specifically.
Well, I just found these are called the sumo oranges from Japan, and they're really cool, but never mind.
Well, so, I mean, give it a taste. Maybe it has its own supernatural powers. You never know.
Well, that's what I was going to say. This is where you move to magical realism. And, you know, everyone's going to say Gabriel Garcia Marquez. But it's also like a Ray Bradbury story in the Martian Chronicles that I remember. And
is it? That's one of my favorite books. But now I'm trying to think, which story are you?
It's the story where the guys are walking through the city, of the ruined city, and they start seeing things like their family and the happiest moments of their life.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
And so anyway, so you create this evocation of the best and the worst of things. And the best are wonderful. But then, I don't want to give away anything. Wait a minute. So when things change, why do they keep going back to get it, even though they know this is what people do in life? Why do people do that?
I think it's human nature in some ways, right? When you think about a relationship, right, sometimes you get hurt really badly, but there are also the highs, and they keep you coming back. And so we see, you know, this, all the ways that these residents in the neighborhood who had this one experience with the fruit, and it had these incredibly potent effects and evoked these all these really positive memories and feelings, not necessarily, you know, pinned to their own past, but just these feelings of positivity. You know, it could be the feeling that you get when you tell a joke and everyone's laughing, or the feeling of you know, what it's like to be inside with the scent of rice cooking and rain outside. You know, all these sorts of just incredible emotions of positivity. And so when things start going sour, not literally, but they're trying to recapture it. And so they try pickling it, you know, they try adding sugar, what have you. They try all sorts of things just to recapture what they lost in some ways. And I think that is a really human instinct, right? Is when we've had something that we've loved, we can't quite accept that it's betrayed us in some ways.
And then I felt so sorry for Sunshine Industries and Fanshi. Mm-hmm. And it's, and then see, you do, like, there's three words, or not even three. You say gapped tooth wife. And that says so much. You know, it's like, why would you say that? You know, it's a good question, right? I mean, you thought about that.
Yeah.
It makes you understand them, but I don't know exactly why. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. No, I mean, I think, just those little details, like, and maybe that's a little bit from my time as a journalist, right? You're always looking for those specific moments or really telling details.
Well, and that's funny too, because like the final man to take the podium, and he's crying and he says, "I'm sorry." And then you realize not only as a journalist, but as a human being, that's what they all should be saying. Mm-hmm. In America or China.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I assume that hits you as a journalist from time to time.
The resonances between the two countries, or what specifically?
No, the idea that someone says they're sorry, but everyone probably should be saying it.
Mm. Well, yeah, and that's something that I found really moving just as I was thinking about this character and writing it, you know, and they're apologizing, you know, or they're feeling in some cases a sense of repentance for what they've done, both on a really individual level, right? Small things that they'd done in their past, but also just this broader national sense too of things having gone a certain way. And yeah, just that incredible sorrow there, both both personal and also on a national level.
And then, like, on Field Notes on a Marriage, again, you have this guy I don't like, and there's so many things in there that you just, like, it's just, like, nuance. It's like when he calls her bunny and she says it's an animal she never liked, or when he gives her the origami, and then mouse, you know, what a horrible thing. And then you say, one, he says one boy, and then he goes to Germany, and you go, okay, well, is he, you know what I mean? Mm. And then his mother, and then perhaps more poignant than anything in the book, and also more at first glance confusing, the last four pages of the story make all the difference. And I had no idea how you juxtapose those and why I'm supposed to, as the reader, connect the two. And, and then you do. But it's like, you know, when they're lugging the bottle, the jugs of water up to the top, and it's like, and again, you know, I'm talking about things that if you haven't read the book, no one's going to know what it is. But I'm just interested in myself. And it's like, okay, you came up with that, but I don't know how you did. How the hell did you do that?
Oh, well, I'm so happy you feel like that ending landed. I struggled with that one.
I bet.
Yeah, it was hard because it's, I mean, I think that also just goes back to what the story fundamentally is about, right? It's this feeling, you know, she's an American anthropologist in a city that reminds me a lot of Berkeley, California. And she's someone who prides herself on her ability to understand people. And she marries a man who fundamentally, she in so many ways just has this incomplete perception of, and despite all of her pride and skills as an anthropologist, she in many ways just has, we see her over the course of that story just having to confront all that she doesn't understand and all that she ultimately will not understand. And so I think, you know, I was talking about it with my husband, and I remember he was saying, well, you know, what about something, an image, you know, just ending with something that tries to convey sort of the in a visual sense, sort of the enormity of that situation she's facing. And so that's what I wound up with, you know, that scene that you're describing just there. And I just loved how it conveys so much of that sense of stubbornness and resistance and also loneliness, but also there's hope there too. And there is, you know, we see some of those kindnesses being administered. And yeah, it was, I think there's a lot of stuff going on in that story, but I'm really glad to hear that ending landed with you.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, there is hope, but then, you know,
but there's strangers too at the end of it, you know, the other end. Yeah, it's
and the mother,
a mixed feeling.
The mother is like two people. Yeah, her new baby, the car, and she's smiling, and then she changes at dinner and all that. And anyway, so next story, Flying Machine, which was, just because I'm a goofball, was my favorite.
Oh, and I'm so pleased to hear that. Mine too.
And again, it's, you know, magical realism of a kind, but, you know, failure may be the only option, but in getting there, we have a feeling of hope. It's like, should a man's reach exceed his grasp, or what to heaven for? You know, I love how he collects things. So I know we're trying to sell your book, but I always go on tangents about my life.
Please, I'd love to hear.
So when my brother and I were little, we built a spaceship, and my father was so angry because he had these beautiful pieces of mahogany that he was going to make something out of the garage. And we used the mahogany to make...
I was picturing cardboard.
No, it was mahogany. And and we thought when we got in it, we actually thought, you know, we're going to go to the moon.
Oh, I love
that. The thing about the main character is that, once again, the reason why, and there are not that many characters in the book that do this, you say he hadn't stopped laughing since. Mm. And that was kind of like a sigh of relief for me. It's funny. It's funny because yesterday my friend Tim, out of the blue, without even knowing I was reading this book, he goes, you know, when people have one leg that's shorter than another, they kind of make fun of them like there's something wrong with them in their head. Uh-huh. And I thought about that yesterday too.
That's
because
funny.
And I also like the way he's such a good man that he, you know, and his wife is so understanding, you know, buying cigarettes and chips and soft drinks, not necessarily for himself, but for his friends. Mm-hmm. And also another story about me and my brother. We on Arch Street, which you're familiar with down in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There used to be, before you were born, there used to be like this whole row of electronic service centers. And so my brother and I thought, well, we can do this. And we made these business cards and put up signs all around the neighborhood. Again, my poor father. And the sign said, after the sale, it's the service that counts. And that's what our business card said. So our idea was when someone's radio broke, we'd pick it up, take it down to the service center, they'd fix it, and then we would mark up the price. So that was an abysmal failure, and he made us go around the neighborhood taking the signs down as soon as he found out about it.
Sounds like a true story.
So I thought of his business cards, inventor and grassroots engineer.
Yeah.
And the poor thing, you know, you think, okay, he's not right, but he wants to be a party member so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do think that kind of spirit is one that you run into in China, and one that I wanted very much to conjure up. Though I did also, I think it's funny, you know, that you mentioned that the story, this is one of the magical realist stories. I'm flipping through it in my mind. Yeah, I know the details you're talking about because, you know, the reader meets these funeral strippers. They meet this robot that makes noodles. And actually, both of those are drawn very much from real life in China, funeral strippers, you know, in which someone dies and you want to ensure a good turnout for their funeral. And so you hire a stripper and these robots that are designed just to make noodles. I mean, both those are real life details. Definitely ones that seem more fabulous, but ones that definitely struck me and delighted me when I was also living in China and wanted to work into this one. But more real life than magical real in this case.
Yeah, and that's about being a journalist. And, you know, the stripper, when I couldn't, what the hell are they doing? That's and then, the robot, because you described it so well, how he was able to cut the noodles exactly the way, and I've seen the way they cut noodles. Yeah, that's kind of cool. But I didn't understand. I said the stripper was, it was cool. And then it was also sad, too, because when his wife gets in the plane, you did a good job with all these things. The way she's carrying the thermos. Mm. The thermos mm-hmm. bothered me. I mean, I felt so bad.
Yeah.
And then she has to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, when he's thinking, and he doesn't give up, he's thinking his robot dog and the shoes that walk on water.
Yeah.
And then the trash can, and you do, I do this all the time. You should stop me if I start spoiling things. But yeah, the trash compactor and the last line of the book. I mean, the last line of the story.
I should stop you. Spoiler.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it. But I mean, yes. That's, you know, okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll stop. Okay. So on the street where you live, which is a song by Lerner and Lowe from My Fair Lady, you have Perry and Lisette. And okay, this can't be true. There can't be a tunnel of love like that. Can there?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Because that's horrible.
Yeah, no, I would hate to go on that ride.
I know. It's like this past 4 years in America, I keep saying things like, you can't make this stuff up. Now, and everyone in the bookstore is sick of me for saying that, but they were already sick of me anyway, kind of. but yeah, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, well, you can't make this stuff up. And then I'm thinking, well, actually, it could happen. I just couldn't make it up. And yeah. So... And it's funny because in that you have Perry and Lisette and our protagonist, and you jump around. Like, first you think one is a good guy, then you think the other one's a good guy, then you think the other one's a good girl, and then you shift them all around. It's kind of weird. It was cool.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked that.
Yeah, and I'll leave that one be. And then Shanghai Murmur. So you go from the man upstairs, you go to the flower shop, the owner. It's cool. To the customer and his wife. And, you know, he does give her his card, so that's something. And then, you know, the place he lives, Triumph Mansion. And I'm just wandering around. But it reminds me when I was in Beijing last time, we adopted our two daughters from China, one from Xi'an. Her name is Ann Tata because the two towers in Xi'an, which was beautiful. And we got to see the terracotta soldiers plus the farmer who had discovered them. And he was like, I guess they made him kind of like have a nice cushy life. Mm-hmm. He sat there in his little lawn chair and
amazing.
And yeah, Annie sat with them and we got a picture of them. That was really cool.
Yeah.
And then, but when I was in Beijing, I realized, in my opinion, it's kind of like when you go to Baltimore down to the water and everything is beautiful, but if you walk two blocks away, it's not so beautiful anymore. Mm-hmm. And in Beijing, actually Shanghai. When I was in Shanghai, it's like New York on steroids, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you're walking around, but if I took a long walk and walked in three streets, there's some old lady with no teeth sleeping, sweeping the road with a straw broom and a mal jacket, glaring at me. And then I have to turn and leave.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a lot of the contrast that I wanted to try and evoke through Shanghai Murmur, through the lens of this young woman working at a flower shop, you know, who, as you described, falls in love with her customer and all that unfolds from there. But to me, that's a story that's very much about both the contrast and also just the sense of longing that exists when you're at the bottom and looking up.
And it's funny because all the readers, but no one in the story, know exactly what kind of pen it is.
That's right.
Do you have one of those?
I don't know, but I've seen one.
Yeah.
And it obviously left an impression on me, just as it did Chalet.
Yeah, I went to the store in the mall and wrote with it. And it does write in a great way. But sort of the Lamy pens, too.
I hope I described it correctly then.
You did. And then you kind of buried this. Your title is Land of Big Numbers, and then that story is like the seventh or eighth one in. And I wondered why you didn't start off with that. But, you know, that's up to you.
No particular reason. I think Lulu, you know, started the collection. It was the first story that was published in The New Yorker. So I think when the editors were putting together the collection, I thought they felt like it was one that thematically, that readers perhaps had already had some awareness of, and then also was thematically just really summed up a lot of what the book was capturing too, just all the choices that people make and that feeling of duality and contradiction that exists so much in modern China.
And the thing is, Land of Big Numbers is cool because once again you were kind of prescient, you know, with GameStop. Robin Hood and AMC.
Yeah.
And if you're a kid who hasn't been through cycles like me in 10 cycles, and I have a very close relative who I won't tell you how close he is, but he sees that he can't lose money, just like your protagonist. Yeah. This is easy. I'll just keep, my father and mother don't know anything. You know, this is easy to do. Mm-hmm. And whatever I've learned is that whenever analysts get together on something like Bitcoin or Tesla or Chinese electric cars, whatever they say, do the opposite. And it was funny also when I was in Beijing that I saw more Lamborghinis there than in South Beach.
I'm not surprised. It's always kind of shocking when you, again, as you were just describing, you know, you walk down a street that looks incredibly humble and then all of a sudden you run into a car like that.
Yeah, and once again, there is still hope. And once again, you give the reader this twist that you think he's going to feel a certain way, but he doesn't. He still feels like there's hope. Anyway, but we know what's going to happen. So, and it, you know, it's funny when I said in the introduction about the similarities between the two countries, that's a particular story that could be the title of a book about America. There's no difference there.
Yeah.
And then the next one is Beautiful Country. And some of the things, again, are like some of the other guys, you know, don't count the change. That's not what we do here.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're like a potato chip and you're like a potato. And, you know, it's not nice. And then I like the way he does these bad knee howls, which I can do. Knee howls, shay shay, and sakien. And I know I'm not saying them right, but that's what I can do.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, Eric, that character, I think he's a good guy, well-intentioned, bumbling.
He's not a good guy. He's not a good guy.
Really? I feel like I've met so many guys like him who are, they kind of rub you the wrong way at times. They say things that are stupid, but he means well. And I think that's why the character loves him. I mean, I'm flawed, certainly, but so are most people in this world.
No, not your husband. Not your husband. He's exactly the opposite of this.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, so...
I've got a higher bar for my husband than my characters.
I like the way Jessica says, you know, so he takes you to the Grand Canyon. That doesn't mean he's not a jerk. Even the way he calls her pickle, this is like you telegraph this stuff, you know? And did you laugh at all when you were writing this?
At certain bits, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in little ways here and there, I am poking fun at him. But yeah. Not intended in an affectionate way, intended to be in an affectionate way.
So then the last story, which I think is the longest, it's definitely the longest. And it should be the longest because of the weight. But how you pronounce it is
Gubeko.
Mm-hmm. Gubeko Spirit, which is another venture into magical realism. But then I'm thinking, how close could this come to happen? How patient would these people be?
It's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this, of course, was my answer to that thought exercise of what would happen if a bunch of commuters got stuck on a subway platform for months on end. It's for me, the question emerged. I remember coming home on the subway one day back to the bureau in Beijing and just thinking, well, what would happen if we all got trapped? And so, Gubeko Spirit, that's my answer. You see what happens over the course of months to the small community of people, but of course it could play out a million different ways in different countries. But I think in mine, you know, you get to see how they form this kind of insular and cozy little community in some ways, and that they grow actually very comfortable underground. And yeah, and some of them just in the end don't even want to leave.
I know, and it's funny how that happens too, and how the protagonist makes a choice, and the two teenagers. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's funny because they also become heroes in their country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and so much of what that story is trying to evoke too was just like, what is it? You know, this acts sort of as, you know, kind of a dark fairy tale, like a bit of a parable in some ways of life in an authoritarian society when you have so many forces that are telling a certain story, right? And setting up these narratives and emotions, using very emotional ploys in certain ways to try and get people to go along with the script, and how powerful that is. And we see that with these passengers getting celebrated by state media as these heroes, and how they rally together under this idea of Gubeko Spirit. And yeah, I mean, it's written as a sort of a gentle satire, but that all absolutely for me felt like I could imagine that happening quite readily.
Just especially
the psychology there, yeah.
Especially with the computerized voice continuing to say the same thing for days. and yeah, people will put up with those things. They do in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. There's the book. And thank God, through my babbling, you did take the time to actually talk about the stories, whereas I just went off on my own.
No, I love you. Yeah, it's so fun. I didn't realize you had that connection to China. So it's great to get to hear about.
And yeah, and sometimes people say to me, like, oh, I'm so glad you read the story so closely. And it's not like a compliment to me, it's a compliment to you. Why wouldn't I read them closely? They're that good, you know?
No, it's I love getting to talk about the actual stories. And yeah, it's tremendously kind for you to take the time to get to share with your readers.
Yeah, and I've said this to a couple of people, my daughter Annie, who's now 19, it seems like just yesterday. She works in the store, and I've said this before, she is like the hardest seller. What she'll do, she'll take your book and she'll come around the corner of the counter with it and go up to customers and say, you have to buy this. And it's like embarrassing.
Amazing.
But it works. But I, like, I cringe and I go off somewhere into the back room because it's embarrassing. So anyway, you should thank her. Maybe you'll come again. Maybe you'll meet her.
Please, too. I'd love that. Yeah, please thank her. I'm so glad that you guys enjoyed the talk.
Yeah, so if you come out, basically you get on the turnpike, you go past the mall, and the next exit, Downingtown, is where you get off. We're right across the street.
Fantastic. Well, I've Google imaged extensively. It looks like a wonderful place to hang out. I'm so happy to know that Land of Big Numbers is there on the table.
Well, it's our pleasure. And thanks so much for taking the time to bear with me today. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me on. Yeah, really great to meet.
Likewise. Talk to you soon.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.